Welcome to Byte Action Podcast. For those who don't know, Byte Action Podcast is on a mission to bring you raw and filtered journeys of experienced and influential people in video games and creative tech industries. If you want to understand how games are made, who are the creators behind your everyday entertainment, and what it takes to build successful companies, games, and products, then you should give this a listen. So anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
And yeah, appreciate coming over here in the cold. You cycled here?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's kind of I don't have a car here in Barcelona, so I don't need it.
I mean, you can get away with a bike.
Yeah,
cycling here is great.
And when you want to go to the mountains or something, I usually just rent a car because it's so cheap compared to having a car and putting it on a...
Do you rent it through one of the car sharing services or?
I usually do a little bit kind of cost analysis. So I check them out and I check like sometimes the local dealers also have a really good deals. But yeah, usually whatever is easiest and cheapest.
Nice. What was the most interesting place that you've traveled around Barcelona? Is there a place that you normally go to? Do you go like Costa Brava or like?
Usually Costa Brava. Just because like I do some scuba diving, so and they're like a pretty good places there. So that's maybe some of those beaches are the ones that I go the most. And then there's like Tossa de Mar or something like that. It's also kind of quite nice. And there's like a resort there that sometimes you get to pretty good deals there. And it has like a little bit, it's not a private beach, but it's a small beach.
Okay.
And they also have like pools and water slides and whatnot and activities for the kids. So it's kind of
Is that Delfin Verde? Is that what it's called? Because I've been to a similar one with...
It has a camping next to it, right? So it's on a...
They have like camping, and then you can kind of park your car there. You can rent like little houses there. Yeah. And they have water slides. And they have access to the beach as well.
Yeah, so
there's a lot of Dutch people there.
I forgot the name, but it sounds like it. So
might be that, because we went there in August and it was super nice. We rented it out for like 4 days.
Maybe it's that one. I can't find it now easily here on my phone. But
nice. Do you ski?
Yeah, so snowboarding usually.
Snowboarding.
Yeah.
What do you go? Do you go France normally or Barcelona or Finland or Barcelona? Well, like
surprisingly,
Catalonia.
Mostly lately I've been kind of snowboarding in Finland, which is
okay.
A little bit counterintuitive. But like the past couple of years, the snow situation here has been so bad that I haven't bothered to go there. But there's like La Molina, if you know that place.
I never went, but I know. I think you can get there by train.
Yeah, exactly. So what I did a couple of times, I just took my snowboard and went to the train and then spent the day there and then took a train back.
That's cool.
It was kind of a bizarre experience to go there because like you have your snowboarding gear, you have your probably your jacket and whatnot and a little bit kind of wintry clothes and other people out there with shorts and they're kind of but they seem to be like more accustomed to it than I am, so like there was not too much staring.
Okay. But did you go in like March or April or?
It has been a couple of years. So I think I went a little bit off season. So I think it was February probably. February, March.
Okay.
Like 2 years ago or something. Okay. Last couple of years, as I said, it's kind of I've checked the snow situation. It always seems like, not worth the hassle.
We went to France this year. Well, end of like last year. It was December, a few months ago. We drove from here.
Yeah.
It's like an 8-hour drive.
Yeah.
So around Annecy, sort of that area.
Yeah.
I'm not a very good skier, but I like skiing.
Yeah. But that's good. It's beginning, right?
Yeah, it's the beginning. So this time, for the first time, I went on the blue slides.
Yeah.
Blue slides, blue slopes.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I feel more confident now.
Yeah, sure. Good. And there's also those ski schools that you can put your kids into it. So that's kind of fun also. We kind of have teaching our kids ourselves, which is different experience. It's kind of with the parents, they usually kind of are not so receptive to instructions that I heard or seen compared to professional teachers.
Maybe. I mean, this time was the second time we put our son on skis.
Yep.
First time was when he was 3 and
yep.
I felt he was like too small, maybe didn't like it at all. But this time it was a lot more receptive, but it was just us. So I literally took his hand.
The normal hand.
And we went down the slope.
Normal thing.
Yeah.
But it's not too early, I think. Well, it depends on the kids, of course. I've seen, like, in Finland, there was a mother of three alone in the slopes, and all of them had snowboards. And the youngest one, I think it was 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So I was asking, like, how do you do it? And actually, she told that the snowboarding is way easier than skiing for kids, because you don't have to, like, manage the weights of the skis and the boots. You just kind of basically lay on top of, or like stand on top of the board, and it kind of just lean back. And
okay.
The two years old was kind of doing turns and twists, and it was like amazing.
Yeah. So, and I mean, kids, they have no sense of fear, you know. They just go. And
all the forces on the act of falling down are also smaller. So
yeah.
It doesn't hurt that much.
For sure. So you're from Finland originally. Yeah. You grew up there.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up in Finland?
I don't know. Different. I'm actually from like a small, let's say, farmhouse next to like a smaller city. So this, because I don't have any comparison points, so I can't kind of definitely say that this is the quintessential Finnish experience. But like the group of friends, they were smaller, of course, but more tightly knit. So and extra school activities or whatnot, they were more limited. So we had basically like a football in the summer or Finnish version of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the winter, it was skiing or ice hockey and football. So
okay,
end of kind of list of extra nice. Scholar
ice
activities.
Hockey is huge in Finland, no?
Oh, yeah. It's the number one sport in Finland. That's the only time when you see Finnish go totally bananas and berserk is when we win the World Championships.
So yeah.
We don't win them often, but every now and then we do. And then the whole country goes wild.
Nice. And I presume it gets really cold in winter. A bit like in Lithuania, where I'm from.
Yeah. But I think Lithuania, you have it a little bit more moist, the coldness, because you have the Baltic Sea that doesn't completely freeze at that.
Area, no, right? No, they don't. Yeah. It doesn't.
So I think you got it even worse than we do, because like we got like minus 30, minus 25, even minus 35. But that's like the dry cold. So you can put layers on clothes and you will be fine.
Okay.
But with the moisture, it gets to your bones. Like I haven't found a good way to.
It gets really cold. Yeah, it can get really cold. And I remember when I was a kid, I think it was like one winter, it was like minus 25. And I think beyond minus 25, you have to stay at home. Like, they have the rule at schools that you shouldn't go to school, basically.
Oh, okay.
So it was just, you know, just below the point. Then I remember going to school, like my eyebrows are like sticking to each other.
Yeah.
You know, coming to school, like all sort of blue. It was so cold.
Yeah, we don't have those limits.
Okay,
so,
you don't.
Yeah, so we go to school. Like it's not. We only have like if it's. I think it's if it's minus below 25, then the sport activities are turned into indoor activities, and then the recess between the teaching school. Like if we have like 45 minutes, then 15 minutes break and 45 minutes. And that's kind of how we kind of organize the school. And if it's, I think it's minus 25 or minus 30 or something. I don't know how it's nowadays, but when I was a kid, then we were allowed to stay indoors. Like we were not like forced to go outside. Otherwise, it's kind of, you need to go outside and do something and then come back.
Right. Fair enough. What was schools like in Finland? So from what I know, or at least like the general perception is that like Sweden and Finland and Norway, they have like Denmark, I guess, that they have the best kind of schooling systems. I mean, did that feel like that for you or no?
It was more like, of course, it doesn't when you're a kid, it doesn't like you don't have anything to compare. But what I now kind of see from my kids now in their school here, like just comparing the differences, is that like the class, the amount of people in the class or pupils in the class in Finland was much smaller. And the other one is that the teachers were all, they had a university degree on teaching. So they have this fundamental, at least in paper capacity, to try out different teaching methods and really understand how, as well as the scientific community can describe how children are learning stuff. So they can utilize those on the learning stuff. And the other one that in here actually it took us a little bit by surprise was the differences in schools. Like in Finland, like it really doesn't matter that much in which school you put your kids into. Like the experience is going to be more or less the same. The only thing that will change is who you go to school with, like the neighbors. Like you can do a little bit selection nowadays. People are doing just kind of trying to put the people, put your kids into the school where they believe are the kids that will are from the, let's say, better off backgrounds.
Yeah.
But like in the act of teaching or the quality of the teachers or the, let's say, the amount of time that the teacher has to your kid, it's probably like it's fine. Like you can trust that's going to be fine. In here in Spain, like more from my perspective, the class sizes are insane. Like
how many kids are in your...
On my oldest daughter, there's 26 in the school, in the class.
Okay, that's a lot.
That's a lot. They do have one, they have the teacher, and then they have one person who is switching between the classes, just helping the whoever kind of needs help. But still, that's a lot. And in, well, again, I'm on the countryside from a smaller community. So when I went to school, there was like, I think there was 17 of us in a class, and that was a split class. So there was like the third and fourth grade was in the same classroom, and then the fifth and sixth, and they were kind of just dividing which what do we teach to these guys and these guys, and then right. But yeah, so and well, that's kind of the teachers and the amount of people, because that for me kind of has the biggest impact. Like if you have the skills and will to teach your the children as good as you can, and you have as high amount of skills that you education system can provide, university level, and then you have just enough kids so you can kind of help each of them, whoever needs help, that will already kind of elevate the teaching, I think, a lot.
Of course. Of course.
And then the maybe the biggest, I don't know if this is like the same in Spain, but I would say the difference, biggest difference between, let's say, the American version of school system and the Finnish version of school system is that the emphasis, like the whole system in America, as far as I understood, reading from a couple of papers and people who have kids there, is that system tries to push for people to find the geniuses there and push them as far as they can. Whereas in Finland and mostly in Nordics, is that the system is designed in a way that no one is left behind.
Okay.
So there's like the whole system is designed in a way that if somebody is struggling, they will help. And because that's kind of the let's say the Nordic mentality, like you cannot leave anybody behind. if you do that in the wintertime, that guy is dead. So the same kind of mentality probably kind of resonates in everything.
Nice. Well, I like that. I mean, that's why those countries are so successful, I guess.
Yeah, that's because it's because the PISA results and everything, they don't measure the highs. They measure the average, and the average has way more impact if there is like a lot of people who are struggling or they don't get so good scores.
Yeah, right, true. Now, I guess going to yourself then, so from what I read about you, just kind of going through your LinkedIn and doing a little bit of Googling, you have a background in software engineering?
Yep. Yes.
And then you kind of became a producer, right? So you went to project management, became a producer. What brought you into software engineering? What made you want to do that or maybe study that? And, you know, what was your journey then kind of moving from there into games and production?
Yeah, so it's like one thing that you guys need to remember that I'm, well, not old, but have more experience. So when I was a kid, we had the personal computers were just starting to become a thing. So my first computer was something called like Commodore 64, which is a predecessor of a personal computers, PCs. So, and the whole like, let's say, programming wasn't even a thing until I was in quite late in high school, that they started to kind of put some emphasis on it. So, hey, okay, this is a thing that people should learn. And there wasn't that much, let's say, professional education paths available, but then they started to open up. So my first dream job was a Lego engineer, so designing Lego bricks and Lego sets.
Okay.
But then it was a little bit easier to get into the programming of things because I kind of started as a self-taught programmer. So when I had my Commodore 64, I started making programs in Basic. It was the programming language at the time. So really started exploring what I can do with them. And quite fast, I started trying to make some games in there, like rudimentary things and stuff like that. And then that's kind of sparked my interest. Okay, hey, like I can do something. It's kind of cool that I can make this block of plastic and metal to kind of do my bidding in a way.
Yeah.
And then I went to, I think it a university. Yeah. On the university, I started on computer sciences. And there kind of did some basic level of programming skills and whatever they had. I basically tried to scoop as much experience as I could. And then I was young, I needed the money. So I went to do some programming on a couple of places here and there. But I found out quite soon that I'm not the best programmer. The other guys that I worked with were way more, let's say, skilled, and they had way more better capacity of doing interesting stuff on the computers.
Mm-hmm.
But what I learned or noticed that I have way more, let's say, understanding of what the customer wants and what is the end experience of the user. So I ended up talking about what we should do and how we should do it in a, like user interface ways or the whole system ways than actually doing anything. So then I did less and less programming and more talking about things. And eventually I became like a producer. And then after that, I kind of my path has been always, let's say, away from doing stuff and more about designing what should we do, how should we do it, and how it should affect and feel like how it's used or how the end product will be.
Okay.
And then in the background, like again in Finland, there wasn't any too many opportunities to work in gaming. Like there were not too many gaming companies. But I have played basically since I got my Commodore 64. I use it mostly for playing computer games, more or less.
Okay.
So while that was happening, then let's say the first mobile gaming era arrived. So it was the Java or mobile phones, like the really, really first, before iPhones era. So then we started a computer gaming company there with a couple of friends from the university.
All right.
And that was kind of the first stab on computer games. Yeah. And then it has been, let's say, business as unusual in the world of computer games.
Why games in particular? I mean, is it something that you always thought you wanted to kind of end up in?
Yeah, I've always played games. I like them. I like to analyze them, mm-hmm. like how they work. And since I realized that, okay, this is something people actually do, so somebody makes those games. and then it became like a possibility of a career. And then it felt super cool to combine, let's say, like a hobby and a work. So like I have been fortunate enough to work on computer gaming companies a lot of my career. And most of the days when I wake up, I'm super excited to get to work. So, and I think it's a rare thing. No, but like, it's not like a common thing. I'm aware of that. I feel super lucky and super kind of fortunate to have that passion and that kind of work combined.
Sure.
And the stuff that I like really gets to me is that I want to make games that a lot of people are enjoying. So I don't like, there's two schools of things. Like you might want to do like super personal projects that are like, you're pulling your heart into it. Like, this is me, this is my experience as a human being in the earth. And then you do something amazing game that is super personal, has super strong narrative and goes really, really to your body. I always get goosebumps mm-hmm. when I think about those kind of games.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great. Those are super great games. But like, that's not me. Like, I'm not into that kind of game making. I enjoy those games. I want to play those. And quite often I get emotional about them. But what I kind of enjoy the most is these games that as many people as humanly possible can enjoy them and have fun with them and really be kind of almost treat them as a hobby. So they kind of come back to it and it's kind of their break from the cruel world to kind of devote some personal time to something as stupid as computer games. Like, it's they don't do it anything per se. They're just a red button that it's super fun to press, but you enjoy that pressing of that button, and it's up to us to make it so worth of their time that they want to come back and keep doing it, which is as me as a gamer, I can relate to that a lot.
Yeah, and obviously your experience is mostly in mobile games, right?
Yep.
So yeah, those sort of games do provide that kind of aspect of short escape. I mean, I predominantly play mobile games when I'm traveling.
Yeah.
When I'm on the go, on the plane. I don't necessarily play them at home. I probably prefer playing like Xbox and sometimes PC games. But yeah, when traveling, it definitely is mobile. For sure.
Yeah, I have, since I started making my own money, I have had all of the consoles in a way.
Okay.
I had like a Nintendo DS and then Wii and Wii U and now the latest one, then PlayStation. I started from PlayStation 3. I haven't got to the latest PlayStation yet or the latest Xbox, but I have the one generation older there at home. Then a lot of PC games, maybe too much also on mobile games. But nowadays, I find myself that if I have time in the evening, it takes a lot from me to open up a console and start playing. So I rather take a mobile phone out and play something there, because like some of those RPG games and shooters, they're crazy in the mobile space, and it's so easy to start playing.
I know. Now they've improved so much.
Oh yeah, way too
I mean,
much.
The hardware has improved, the phones have improved.
Yeah,
but the games have followed as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What do you play
at the moment? There's this kind of, well, I play a lot of games. I start playing them just because I want to know what other people are doing and what they are kind of up to. Modern Warfare, that's a, kind of my, let's say, go-to shooter on a mobile phone.
Okay.
Because I know they're cheating on me because I'm not that good. So there are bots probably, most likely, that kind of, but I don't mind it. It's fun. Then I played Royal Match, of course. It's a super fun game, really, really perfectly executed. Then lately, a lot of those hyper-casual games, just kind of see where they are guys are going. And what else? Let me see. Usually I play a game like a couple of hours, then I switch to something else.
Okay.
Like Monopoly Go, that's a nice one. So
they've done really well with Monopoly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that by Scopely now?
Yes, it's by Scopely, yeah. And they've done an amazing job there. It wasn't an easy journey for them, but the end result is really, really, really good.
Did you have a chance to work on that when you were in Scopely?
No.
No?
No, it was done by a different okay. bunch of people. But I got to play some early version of it. Like there was an internal playtest, and a lot of that fun that is now on the App Store, you could already see it on there. So,
yeah, I mean, that game's sprung a lot. Coming back to your then experience, so you mentioned you started your own company. Mm-hmm. Were you making games? Were you working with like publishers? And
so we were working on two games. One of them we managed to self-publish. The other one we didn't get the chance to finalize. We were trying to find a publisher for that game. And then we worked as a subcontractor to make some games for Nokia feature phones. So,
okay,
kind of a bag of mixed things. So there was a racing game, a football game, a puzzle game, and then the couple of games that we did.
That's back when Nokia was still the market leader.
Yeah, yeah. And Java was the language, or Symbian.
Okay.
So that's kind of the last time that I professionally did any piece of code for game.
Okay. And then at some point you switched into production and you joined Rovio?
I joined first on to Bugbear.
Uh-huh.
The company has made like Flatout series, like these rally driving games. And then Rovio, yeah.
Okay. What was it like working there? I mean, Rovio and Angry Birds, I think, is this Finnish export that a lot of people know about, sort of in probably put it in the same level as like Supercell.
Yeah.
I don't know, Finnish vodka.
Yeah.
type of thing. So so what was it like working there?
When I joined Rovio, it was the era where it was still hyper growth. So it was a huge company with a lot of different departments. So there was the soft drink side, and then there was the playground side, books and comics, movies and TV shows, games, plush toys, probably something else that I forgot. But we had they were renting offices in a big complex. So there was like five different buildings and something like 15 or 14 different floors of people working.
Wow.
So And when I joined, the company was still making like premium games. So it was like a 0.99 cents a game. But it was already kind of, you could already see that the free-to-play game kind of industry was starting to pick up. And I think the biggest thing there was then when, all of that expansion didn't pay off. And then the change of from premium games to free-to-play started to kind of, it forced the company to make a lot of changes, quite drastic ones, which I think were needed ones. So. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, change management that I got to see on firsthand and also participate, especially the changing of the mindset from one business model to another. So from this business model of, hey, let's do a game, let's push it out $1.99, and then let's start making another game versus like free-to-play model where you make constant updates and
right, live service
and the game, the act of making a game, it's just one small step on the whole business, rather than in the premium one. Hey, if you can make a game, then you need to put it there, push it, and then move on.
Why did a company switch to that eventually? I mean, was it just because they realized they could make more money, like monetization?
No, the whole premium business was dying out. Like if it's, and you could clearly see it, like it's hard to compete against free, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, even if you own the phone, I mean, the first thing you go to when you need to like download new apps, you check out all the free apps that you can download, right? So I guess it's the same when you're downloading a game.
And it's even more like it's almost impossible to get people to spend like any meaningful amount of money on a premium app on a mobile phone. And then there's a couple of reasons. One is that for free, you don't have any risk of downloading and giving it a go, because let's face it, some of those 99 cent games that you probably tried out were garbage. Like you didn't like them at all. So, and the other one is that also the quality of the free-to-play games back in the day, and even now, it's insane. If you like, that's a game that you get for free. Well, if you see how much love and effort has put in there, all the feedbacks, and like Call of Duty, for example. Not Call of Duty, but Modern Warfare. Mm-hmm. If you get that, that's a free game. Like, it's insane. Like, you think about it, like, I get this for free, and I can play it as long as I want, and have really, really good time or fun. And I'm not forced to, the best games, you're not forced to spend anything. You can just keep playing if you want to.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to kind of compete on the installs. And then on the other one is that also like the nature of free to play is that you get the same customer to allow them to spend more or like multiple times. So it's like a repeated spender is way, way more, let's say, interesting. Also harder to retain, because you need to have a lot of things, interesting stuff. It's like you need to be worth their while and time. But and that was kind of transitioning what was going on, and you could clearly see that business was going down. So even releasing, I forgot what game that we released at the time, I think it was like Angry Birds Star Wars, for example, and Star Wars 2, and even that we could see that every kind of release after another one was kind of getting less and less like installs, just because of the price.
Okay.
Because you could clearly see that Angry Birds and Star Wars, the two brands combined at the time, they should have gotten like a way more downloads than they did. So there was like a clear indication. And the other one was that Candy Crush was starting to kick in also. So that was called like a super eye-opening, at least for me. Like for me, it was always like, what are the players trying to tell us on their behavior or feedback or whatever? And a lot of the designers back in the day in Rovio, and a lot of the guys were saying, hey, that's the wrong way of making games. You shouldn't make games like that. The game should have a price, people should pay it, and then they should enjoy it and then move on. Like, that's the way how games are supposed to be enjoyed. But that was not the case that was happening on the markets. You could clearly see that people were downloading Candy Crush, playing it for months on and really enjoying it and kind of every now and then spending a little bit of money on there just to because they enjoy it, not because they are forced to. So for me, that was so clear, but there were a lot of people who were kind of super against that kind of design. Hey, we shouldn't design games that don't have any ending. That's what are you talking about? And the game should have everything that you need there embedded on the game. You shouldn't have to buy anything to kind of enjoy the game more. But there was also like a lot of, back in the day, a lot of misconception on what free-to-play means, because some of them, they just associated that so clearly on like strict paywalls or casino game kind of mentality in the background or something like that. So they had,
right.
So they had like a mindset that was super, super narrow what the game should be. And changing those designers' perspective, that took a while. So in our studio, I would say it took like probably like 7 to 9 months or even a year to kind of transform some of those people's mindset yeah. to be really kind of from like resistance to quietly crutching, but not fully accepting, then maybe accepting, and then one wanting to understand and then utilize. So it was a long journey for some people. So,
because I presume it used to be like that, and I think some of the games are still like that, where they allow you to play a little bit, and then if you want to continue and play more, then you have to pay, right? Is that what you mean by like paywall?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's I think maybe the best or worst example is the Mario Run. Like you can play the couple of first levels there, and then there's a strict, now you need to pay, which is kind of, it's, and I've been thinking about that example a lot, because I think for me, I think Nintendo would have been probably made, in that game in particular, probably it would have made more sense to put that on a premium game. Because I think the brand would have been okay to kind of pull enough people now that they were kind of lured into, hey, this is free, and then they had this strict paywall there, which probably kind of stayed away a lot of people. But I for Nintendo, it has been a long journey on free to play, and I don't think they have gotten really, really better of it. But it's still, for them, it seems super, super difficult.
What's the future of mobile games, in your opinion? In a sense, like, you know, we're going to be making these devices better, and I presume mobile games are going to get better quality and graphics. But is there any like fundamental change? Like for me, going into this free-to-play model is like a fundamental change in how games are played. Is there anything like that on the horizon, do you think?
That's a good question. Like one fundamental change was also the hyper-casual. And for me, the hyper-casual market had like one fundamental change that not too many talk about, but for me it has been like, it's a business model. Okay, so you get most of the money from people, from exposing a lot of people for ads, and then making a game that the idea is so ridiculously well defined that when watching an ad you understand, okay, so this game is about that, and it somehow interests you. So you go there, you download it, you play, you see some ads, and then you go away. So it was like almost as the same similar mindset of a premium game. So you get the player into your game for a while, and you push ads to it, and then the player is supposed to go away almost, because there's no end game, there's no nothing. And if the player also doesn't leave your game, then the amount of money that people are willing to spend on showing ads on your game will go down, because the game is too sticky in a way. So for me, that was a kind of interesting note. But I do think, like looking at the free-to-play market now and also what is happening on hyper-casual side, on the ad side, I think it's there's two things. One is that we don't have any new players on the mobile phones anymore. And what I mean by that is that we don't have any people who haven't ever played any mobile game ever.
Okay.
So there's like all the customers that you're gonna have, all the new players, they have played something in the past. And it's the same almost like for moviegoers. Like if you start watching movies, at some point you start to define your own taste. Like these are the types of games or movies I like, and these are the types of movies I will go to see in the movie theater, and these are the movies that I will stream or whatever. And the same similar is going to happen on a mobile phone. So there's going to be on the games. And I think that's one of the reasons why like hyper casual and also to some extent free to play, the price of getting a user into your game has risen a lot. Of course, there's the Apple and Google changes on that. privacy side and whatnot, and that has a huge impact. I'm not negating that at all. But at the same time, I think it takes more and more interesting effort and more different kind of games to get players away from their existing game and into a new game. And the existing games are getting, because they are service, so by nature of a service, it's getting better and better and better. So the game is improving, you're having new stuff, it's a game that you kind of like, there's always something new and fun going on there, so it's harder to get back to. So, and after all of that rambling, what I think that will happen in the mobile games in the future is that we're going to see more and more kind of, I think, like experiences that you could compare to Roblox, for example.
Okay.
Like more of this kind of...
So where you can make your own stuff, like user-generated
content? Well, I'm agnostic on where the content, who has made the content. That might be AI or user-generated or whatever. But why I say Roblox is that it's kind of one place where you go and you don't kind of download anything new. So you just go there and you know that there's going to be fun for you for some reason, like a new game or existing game or something. But it's not going to be like app store-driven finding a new game kind of explorer market. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be more stagnated. People are going to stay with the same game, or they're going to go into, I don't know, hyperverse or mechaverse or whatever you want to call it, like more deeper engraved experience where you transfer your avatar or some parts of your previous gaming history. You carry it around in a way, maybe not affecting the new game, but that's what I think is going to happen. So,
okay.
People are going to be more lazy to find out new things. Well, not lazy, but I think it's like more resistance on trying something that is just something that they have seen in the past.
Sure. I mean, for me as well, when it comes to mobile games, the premium games, I guess, the games that I'm paying for or that I have paid for in the recent times, like one of them was Monument Valley. I think that was it.
That was a good game, yeah.
It was a really good game. Yeah. But it's because... like I knew a little bit about the studio and like I knew the game from before. I think I played it on somebody else's phone and yeah. I really liked it. So yeah, I don't know how much it costs now. I think maybe it was like €5 or €6. I mean, yeah. But it was worth downloading, and it's the game that stays on my phone.
Yeah.
Because you feel invested in it, first of all. You know, you already spent some money, but at the same time, you know, it's a good game to come back to and to kind of get lost. And, you know, I like the puzzles and, you know, they did a really good job with the quality as well. And then the other one, I've downloaded this educational mobile game for kids.
Yeah.
So sometimes I give it to my four-year-old to play.
Yeah.
And I don't know, they can teach him, I don't know, letter, like counting and letters. And
Yeah, it's the... I think Monument Valley was, I think it was one of the last kind of games, let's say on the indie side, where Apple and Google were still able to push new games into players. Because nowadays, I think it's like, in my opinion, the current Apple Store, it doesn't appeal me at all. Like I can't find anything fun in there. Like if I open it, I know it's going to be a disappointment.
Right.
Like personally, what I've heard from other people, that they share the same experience. Like there's the same stuff. It's really hard. It doesn't kind of give you kind of anything surprisingly. It's always the same games.
But is the reason because all these companies that own those games, they just pay so much money for marketing and it's to push their games forward to the players, and they don't necessarily push out the games that indie developers make? Or
yeah, I would, well, every now and then Apple tries, but since the like 90% of the content that is there is like, if I go there any random day,
right,
I'm gonna see the marketing efforts of a huge company that has the same game on a top 10 list for 3 years 4 years, and I that's the first thing I see. Then the likelihood of me coming there on another day trying to see, okay, what's new, what's fun in there, it's gonna diminish a lot. So I think it's just that they have, by the way they changed the App Store,
mm-hmm.
and probably also the way the markets have evolved, and so it's always like connected. But what they have taught the users of iPhone is that the App Store is quite a boring place, and it's really hard to unteach it. And that's why I think that kind of, like when Hypercasual was working well, that was the good thing about Hypercasual, because it was like almost like an app store in the form of an ad. Like you find a game, you start playing it, and you get kind of ads from something that they think are interesting to you, and that because the algorithms try to find the thing that you like. Eventually, you got something that you got kind of your attention. So, but on the App Store, on Apple side, it doesn't work. And on Android side, I think it's almost the other way around. So they have like, and for me, it might be the nature of the two companies, the culture. Apple has always been like, we will tell you what you will like. And that's kind of...
We know better.
We know what you will like, and that's yeah. it. Whereas in Google, they have always been on a behavior and data first kind of company. So what I feel like when I open an Android store, I always get something that's at least mildly interesting, like a game of that type, but a little bit different.
Okay.
Or so, I think that's kind of an interesting approach, or personal observation at least on me, for me. So I don't know. It's hard. Like I think the Monument Valley was the last game that Apple knew how to push, and they were. It's a great game. I'm 90% sure that there are great games on the indie side also that also Apple tries to push, but they don't know how to do it anymore. So I don't think they're gonna see similar kind of success stories anytime soon.
Sure. No, that's
unfortunately.
That's fair enough. So you were at Rovio. You worked there for many years, and then at some point you decided to move to Barcelona.
Yeah.
What made you come here?
Morbid curiosity. So it was like me and my wife, we always kind of thought we want to live abroad a little bit at some point in our lives. And then it was just kind of perfect timing on the kids that, like, we had two daughters at the time. Now we have three, but the oldest one was 3 years old and the younger one was a little bit more over 1 year. So it was super easy to pick the kids up and then bring them here. And then start to try out a new life, like with little risk. Like if you try to take a teenager to another country, another city, like good luck with that. That's it's doable.
Yeah.
But at least for us, it felt easy. So that was the main driver there. And there was a company called Social Point that kind of reached out to us and hey, to me. And then they were just bought by Take Two at the time, so they were growing a lot, and they had like ambitious plans to branch out and make more new games, and the HR side of their, I think that was the best example of HR that I've seen, and Scopely comes really good second in terms of kind of onboarding and making making us feel welcome. Like there was a trip that we did here in Barcelona, so we get along with area a little bit. The company there and the HR guys, they took great care of us. And then they even had like a booklet like that I could hand over to my wife. Hey, this is what will happen if we decide to move. So it had like schools, kindergartens, a little bit of private insurances, how they work, then like different areas of Barcelona and what they are.
Nice.
If you decide to move, like which area would interest of you,
right?
So yeah, that was really well. So we felt confident. Okay, hey, let's give it a go.
So they brought you for like an on-site interview, and they did all that trip, gave you the booklet.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Good.
So then after that, it kind of felt okay. This will be like a fun adventure. So that's how we went here, or that's why we went here.
Wow. What was your role at Social Point?
So it was a vice president of games or new games, I think.
Okay.
Which was just a like I would say it was equal to executive producer or that type of, so they played a little bit with the names of the roles to kind of get people more interested.
Yeah.
But for me, like personally, I've never been like hunting for role names. My career has always been like I want to make games or turn good games into excellent games. So the role was to come up with a business, like a game and a business plan, and then to form a new kind of a team around it and start prototyping and making that game. So
that's
what I got interested in. New country, new city, a little bit warmer than Finland, different food, and then opportunity to kind of make games.
Is the game out? Are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, I think I'm allowed to talk about it. So we did we started making, so that's kind of maybe an interesting journey to talk about that, because it's kind of the difference between, let's say, Finnish and like, let's say, standard Finnish gaming company culture to what I have experienced, like, let's say, different company culture in Spain, at least in my experience and in social point. The reason I love working in Rovio, and I think I still have friends there who work there, and I think the company culture has remained the same, is that it's kind of, let's see, the trust that people are trying to do their best, mm-hmm. and they know what they're doing, and you don't need to micromanage. Like, that's if there's three simple bullet points from Finland, that would be it. There's a lot of more details and whatnot interesting, but those were the things that are were different in when I started in Social Point. So in there, the kind of the first things that, like, a senior programmer was telling me when we started the act of prototyping the project, he said that, hey, Antti, you need to tell us what to do. And I was like, no, that's not how that's not how things work. Like, I cannot, like, how does it work? Like, I'm supposed to make all the decisions on making the game or making the prototype, even the decision of what kind of architecture and everything we should do. Like, that's not how this is gonna work, because, like, you need to want to make a good game. You need to want to excel in your old profession, and you need to kind of care enough to kind of do the thinking. Because if you don't care, or if you're not allowed to, that's another aspect mm-hmm. of it. Like, some people don't care for various reasons, and other company culture, they don't allow you to make the decisions. Like, and that was, I think, the later was pretty much the case in Social Point back in the day, because the company has grown a lot. There were two founders who started the company basically from nothing, and they had to do a lot of things and grow, and they were young people and with games, especially when the games are growing fast and the company is growing fast, you need to grow a lot as a person and as a leader and an organization. And those are the things that usually are not measured that well. It's the game and the business that is measured. So sure. Those things are easily left, let's say, alone, or not alone, but neglected, or there's no time to put too much effort on it. So that was the first journey, like trying to change the team from the Spanish, well, not Spanish, I would say, Social Point kind of mindset of, hey, somebody will tell us what to do, into, hey, let's figure out what we need to do. And that also took a while. I think it took like 4 to 5 months. Luckily, I had like a really good designer, Ignacio, there to help me. And then we had a producer also who was kind of like a really good coach on agile mentality, like methodologic. So it took a while to get the change fully embedded to the team, and in a way that, hey, we could actually start kind of figuring out things. And at the same time, we were still trying to figure out what the game is about. Like, we had a rough idea that it's going to be like a puzzle RPG type of experience with the mechanics that we, like a blasting mechanic. But the kind of the main question that we were trying to answer is like, why the players should play our game and not something else, right? So, because we didn't want to make a carbon copy of an existing game. Empires and Puzzles was kind of the growing game at the time. So we didn't want to make that game specifically. We wanted to make a game of that type, but something that would kind of have an influence. And then it took a while for us to kind of iterate the idea and the world and the stuff. And then at one point we settled into like a mix of puzzle RPG with story-driven games. So
okay.
Like a Telltale type of games, like Walking Dead or something, where the story branches out and then you need to make this huge kind of story-driven decisions, and then it kind of all boils down back again and then branches out and back. So it kind of feels a personal journey, even though it's not that wide as a Fallout style of things or anything like that. So, and the world was kind of also heavily influenced by the mature fantasy kind of the elements. So the world of Song and Ice, like the that was a heavily influenced.
Sure.
Game of Thrones also was kind of playing at the time, so that took a lot of inspiration from there. And yeah, we made the game. We made the prototype. We got it to the app store. So we got some first hand kind of numbers there. Game looked semi interesting. Like it wasn't amazing KPIs, but something that could have been worked with, especially taking that it was our first release. But the cost per install, all the advertising costs, we could already see that, okay, it's going to be really expensive game to try to scale up. So then we decided to kill it and move on. That's the games business in a way. Right. Because most of the games that you're going to make are not going to make it. Like statistically, no.
You test it out in like a single market or a few markets and you kind of see how it's panning out.
Yeah, we tested out in a couple of markets. We did some ads and analyzed a little bit the ads, like how are they, like not just to see that what's the price, but like how are the players interacting with the ads? Like, are they watching it fully? Are they clicking it? Are they interested in what's out? So we did some a little bit deeper in analyzing there, and like nothing of that looked promising. So that's why we decided to move on. Even though the game felt good, was kind of a lot of people inside of the company were quite excited about the world and the interplay between serious story-driven kind of activity and the RPG elements. So it felt like a good idea, but at least the marketing tests were showing that there wasn't that much interest of that type of game at the time, at least.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing with mobile games, as you say, you know, I guess they don't take as long to make as do the console and PC games.
Yeah, ideally, no.
But yeah, at the same time.
Yeah, but it's the same in PC also, like, and console. Like, if you need to make a game that people are willing to spend.
Sure.
And the earlier that you can tell that it's going to be the case or not, the better it is for you, because then you can still do something else. Like, the worst thing is that you put your own money, time, and heart and soul into something that nobody is playing.
True. Or you spend millions and millions on games and having hundreds of people working on it on something that, you know, makes some money, but I guess doesn't make enough for the costs.
But the smaller you are, the less people you need to enjoy your game. So that's kind of also the...
True.
Also the kind of the... And that's like one of the reasons why big companies have some trouble of launching new games, because the new game that they're going to launch, it's going to take away people and focus and effort from the existing games that might be doing really well. So the new game needs to do amazingly well before there's any reason for you to kind of put effort on it.
I mean, nowadays you see, especially with like PC, maybe even console games, there's so many games that launched that have been successful recently that, you know, had fairly small teams working on it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you played Enshrouded.
Nope.
It's like a survival PC game.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly small company in Germany called Keen Games that did that. Like Pal World, is it called? Is another
not
one?
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so from what I'm noticing, there's like a boom of indie developers and indie companies doing really well with the sales of the games, and bigger companies that are making these like AAA games, they're not doing that well.
There's a little bit of like, let's say, survival bias there, because like there's a huge amount of indie developers who are putting out games and nobody knows about.
That's true.
And then you only know the ones that get penetrated by that. I think that, and it's really brutal, because like you're like a small developer, you're doing your stuff, and then there's like maybe five of you or six of you or even less. And then you get the game that like surprisingly goes viral. And then everything breaks, because like your servers are not ready for that. The whole game is not working, and it's like the Among Us, I think, is a really good example of that. And people are furious about them, like, why don't you fix it? Like, okay, there's only four of us.
We're trying.
Yeah. So, and like a similar stuff with, I think, like it's a Vampire Survivors. I think it's the PC game. So they did amazingly well on a PC and Steam side, because it was a small company. They were not able to kind of expand to the mobile side for a long, long time. And then other people made the same game there already. And by the time they released their own version on the mobile side, it was already kind of, the market was done. So it's brutal. So if you stay small, well, it's a positive problem, of course. Like if you stay small and your game goes viral, then you have crazy times at some point in your history. Hopefully that happens to you, but statistically not.
Sure. What's like the typical launch strategy or marketing strategy when you're doing a mobile game? And I mean, is it what you sort of told me? You have to test it out in a few markets, see if it works. If it doesn't work, you kill it. Is there like, fundamental steps that you need to undertake? And how, like, when do you need to start thinking about, I guess, the launch and the marketing and the monetization of the game? Like, what?
As early as possible, yeah. Of course. Like, the earlier you get it, the better it is. And there's like multiple ways of making games and multiple ways of making good games. So I think one, for example, with, let's say, from Scopely, like a fundamentally different way of making games than for Social Point and in Rovio. Like in Scopely, what Scopely does and where it's best at, I would say, is kind of taking this evergreen brands and just making a really good game around that. Like Star Trek, for example, is quite a good example of that. Execution, and then Monopoly, I think it's a great example. Like they worked on the Monopoly game for years, different versions of it, different iterations, but they knew once we get a good Monopoly game, it will go
sure.
Great. I don't know if they know how great it will go, because it has gone like amazingly well, but the brand has like a definitely, like, it gives you like the good thing about the brand is that it gives you a certain amount of certainty that the game, somebody will care about the game. Of course, you don't always get it right. Like this Scopely games like Looney Tunes probably hasn't done as well as they hoped, just because the brand at the game didn't kind of correlate that well.
Sure.
But the downside of doing things like that is that you need quite good muscles on the business development side to negotiate those deals. And once you do like a Monopoly game, it's really hard to, let's say, soft launch that type of a game, because you will get like, let's put it like other way around, like a Star Wars game. If you try to quietly soft launch that, that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
like,
no,
somebody will find out, yeah. And then you get more attention that you want to. So you need to put a lot of effort to the game to make it good. Like it needs to be excellent on launch. So you need to have like a lot of investment before you even get the game out. Then there's the other way around that you can do is like what we did sometimes in Rovio, is that we tried to isolate the brand and the mechanic. So we had because we knew at the time that, okay, Angry Birds will have like a good pull, so we can get people interested about the game, mm-hmm. just because of the brand. So we made a game that was not an Angry Birds branded game, but had them, like we knew, okay, when the game goes out, we just replace these and these with the birds, and it will be fine. And then kind of test if the mechanics has the pull and the game performs in a way that people come back to the game, they want to play it, and they are entertained. And then there's the hyper casual way, which is basically almost you do almost not every time, but you almost do the ad of the game first. So you see if that type of a game has any appeal at all, and then if you see something positive, then you try it out. It's all about the cost of doing things. Like for a typical hyper casual game, you should be able to put that out in a matter of a couple of weeks. So then it's almost cheaper to get the game into an app store and test it out, mm-hmm. than to have like a bunch of high level executives talking about should we make the game. Like most likely the cost of that meeting is higher than the act of making that game in the app store, okay. In a way.
Okay.
Not entirely. I'm a little bit kind of exaggerated. That's like the fun, like the difference. So there's plenty of ways to make fine games and make them good.
What was the product or a game that you enjoyed working on the most?
Oh, good question. So I would say that the product or the team that I enjoyed the most was in Social Point, just because I got to kind of be part of that transformation of that team's mentality and that, sure. part. So I, even though it was a struggle and it took a lot of effort, I think I'm quite proud about that. And then in terms of the game, I would say like the Angry Birds Blast That was a kind of a, that was, we were working together with Rovio and a developer in China called Maibo.
Okay.
So that process also was, because I loved the game mechanic at the time. It had a like interesting spin. And the guys were also, even though they were, that was a, like a Chinese company, but they wanted to be as close as, let's say, like a Western developer as possible in terms of creativity and how they organize their work and whatnot. So they had read a lot of how Supercell works and how the teams are working. So they tried their best to work like that. Of course, they were the Chinese kind of background there. So it wasn't Supercell nor it was supposed to be, mm-hmm. but that was kind of fun because those guys were super eager to learn and try out and they didn't have any kind of, let's say, like mindset that, hey, no, we need to, it has been always done like this, so we need to do it like that. So they were kind of super eager to test out new things because they wanted to learn how to make games for West. So that was fun also.
Okay. Interesting. What's your, you spoke a little bit about your leadership style when you mentioned about, when you talked about Social Point, that you tried to change sort of people's mentality. Do you have a leadership style, do you think, or does it depend on the situation and you sort of try and, you know, see how things are at and try and kind of,
I think, like,
adapt to it.
Leadership style, what I've seen and what I've learned of me there is that is so engraved in your, let's say, your personality, mm-hmm. that your personality has like a huge impact on your leadership style. It has to be like that. And I've seen that like a couple of leaders, even senior leaders who knew in theory how to be more empowering, how to be more kind of, let's say, closer to Supercell, like having the trust in the team and like making that. So they knew all of that in theory and they wanted to lead like that, mm-hmm. and they put some effort on this is how it's supposed to do. They were talking, this is how we do it, this is on you, you are the best, but still when there was like a stress level situation or something, then they defaulted back to the one that they were previously kind of using. So at least it's super hard to change that, or it takes a lot of time, and when you are a leader, even one rehabs onto the old leadership style is critical, because then people are kind of seen through you, or they are conflicted, and they don't know what to do, and then usually people will find a way to find the path of least amount of punishment. That makes sense. So if they know that, okay, there's a chance that we will go back to the old way of finger pointing and that kind of stuff, so then they won't try to put their necks out and really kind of think themselves. So my leadership style is something that has been described to me, which is, I think it's quite accurate, is let the Swedish leadership style, in a way, even though I'm not Swedish, but no, so it's like I want to distribute the decision making as much as possible and create processes and create like mechanics that people are able to make decisions without me, mm-hmm. as much as possible. Because like there's, and this is what I believe, is that there's always more decisions to be made that you have time to make them. Like if you're making a small game, then maybe you can do everything. You can make all the decisions, all the color choices, everything.
Sure.
It doesn't mean that you're going to do the best job of it, but probably you can do it. But what I wanna do is that I wanna trust that the people we have hired to the company or the friends that I'm making the game or whoever, they know something more about something else than I do. So that's why the decisions should be kind of not up to me. It should be up to the team and up to the process. It's up to me to decide what are the fundamentals or the pillars or guidelines or tenets or whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. But these are the five things that this game has to be. Like it needs to be, for example, it needs to be easy to pick up and learn. It needs to have infinite replayability. It needs to be enjoyed by the, I don't know, puzzle gaming community or something, or whatever we decide those pillars to be, then as long as you made the decisions respecting those pillars, I should be fine with it. And if I'm not, the first reaction shouldn't be that, hey, you made the wrong decision. It should be like, how did we end up here? Like, guide me through the thinking process. And maybe there's a thing that I don't know, or there's a thing that he didn't think about, or maybe the process is wrong, or maybe we have a wrong pillar, then we need to tweak the pillar or whatever. But it should always be to trust the process in a way. So I think there's a couple of books that I've read. One of them was this, how the decision-making process was changed in by the United States Army in Iraq back in the day when they occupied the country. And the other one was Turn That Ship Around. It talks about a nuclear submarine that the commander got under his command. And all of them were in the same lines of, hey, we need to allow people to make the decisions on the spot. Like, the whole system needs to design around that. And for me, if an agile company called United States Army is thinking that that's the best way to do stuff, then for me, it's a clear signal that
especially in like life or death situations.
Yeah. we are making games, so it's not life and death situation. But so hierarchical and rooted in fundamentally, somebody will tell you what to do mentality. If they are changing their mindset, then for me, it's a super clear signal. And the other, let's say, influential books are like the From Good to Great. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's Built to Last is the other one, which also talk about the whole, like, these great companies that were good, but were turning great. Like, what changed when what was the kind of the common things in there? And also, like, comparing to other similar companies that didn't turn into great companies, what was the kind of the difference between those? And all of the things there is, what is common is that they have created a process that will outlive any leader in the company. And also they have set of pillars or foundation or whatever that will guide the decision making. Like, it should be powerful enough to be used in a meeting to make a judgment call on a decision. Is it the right one or not one? Just by the process and the pillars. So that's super rambly, sorry.
But that's kind of my
leadership style.
I like the approach. Another question then on leadership and maybe building teams. What makes a good team? Like, why certain teams succeed and others fail? And how do you build a successful team?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, right? So the one kind of definition I've heard, which is, I kind of like it, is that to have as diverse team as possible, that they are still able to communicate effectively. So, and the reasoning for that is that if you have people from different backgrounds and different traits and walks of life, and they are still able to communicate, meaning like work together and understand the fundamentals and the process and are willing to put in the effort, most likely they are going to have the more unique and the best ideas. So that's one aspect, like the ability to generate really good ideas that needs to be embedded on the team. Like, that's that's the fundamental. Like, we are making computer games which don't do anything. So it has to have good ideas in it to be able to make any sense. And the other one is the team cohesion. So they need to work somehow well together as persons and human beings, because if we are making an excellent game, we're going to work together for years. And it's better be like a team of people that you know you're comfortable working with, other than people that you're constantly fighting or fighting with a non-trivial things. Like, I think it's okay to have really heated arguments and discussions about an aspect of the product or aspect of the game, because I think that's normal and that should be the case. But it should stay on that level and not go personal. It should be like, there should be a... And I believe that's why the pillars and the process also is a great tool, because if you use those pillars and the process, and if they're good ones, that's also a way to settle an argument. For example, maybe this is like more on the process side, you come to a point where you cannot agree on how to do it, then we test it out. maybe we flip a coin and then we first test this one and then we test yours or whatever. But there's a, like a way to diffuse like a really heated and important discussion. And the third one is skill. And like computer games and mobile games and games in general, it's a pretty brutal place. Like you need to be able to do complex things fast. They need to look great. They need to work. Because nobody is playing a game that is full of bugs. And the players always have the option to walk out, meaning not coming back to your game again. Like if you're making a business-to-business software that you sell to the CEO and they will make it installed on your company, you can fuck about a little bit more than with a game that is free to play. Like if there's a problem in there, nobody can escape. They still need to use your product and you have all the time in the world to fix it.
Sure.
But on a mobile game, the problem shouldn't be there in the first place. So
the interest can disappear pretty fast. And somebody they don't like it.
Just think about it. Like if you have been playing something for 20 minutes and then the game crashes and you need to play that part again, not going to happen.
No.
And if you do it once, you already lost them, but maybe you got lucky. And then if it happens again, then you're gone. Like there's no amount of money that will get you back to the game, playing that game again. So it's, for me, the ideal team. It's diverse enough, ability to communicate and work together, and skills. It's not rocket science in a way. It's computer games. But that's the way to do it. You can compensate those things. So if you are willing to put the effort and learn new things, then skill can be compensated. And then diversity is again something that if you try to be open-minded and whatnot, maybe you can compensate that a little bit, but personality clashes, that's something that I don't think you can ever compensate. So if the team is toxic, it is toxic. So it's almost impossible to fix.
Yeah. It's important to hire the right people. And it's important to make sure that enough people in your team talk to the person that you want to add to your team now, so that everybody kind of feels that new hire is a good fit, because then it's...
Yeah, because you as a leader, you need to come to the terms to the fact that you are going to hire a wrong person eventually. It's a thing that will happen to you. Sometimes all the checks that you do, all the interviews, they see that, okay, this should be a good thing, but for some reason it doesn't work. But then you need to have you should almost when you start hiring, you should have at the same time, you should have a way to get out, or like path to like, how do I recognize that this person was the wrong hire? And then how do we cope with it? Like, because it's going to happen.
Sure.
Hiring is difficult, you know? So, and eventually you're going to hire the wrong person. But yeah.
In your last role, you worked on games, like an in-car entertainment.
Yep.
Games.
Yeah.
Like what would the game? I never played a game in the car, probably because I have an older car as well.
Yeah.
So were you making like games for, I don't know, Tesla, or I don't know?
It was.
Or was it kind of a different concept? Or because from my perspective, you know, I guess Tesla has, you know, big enough screen and they have entertainment in the car that you can use and play. I don't know if there's any other cars that do that nowadays. I'm just curious.
It's kind of the whole car industry is moving into that direction, because they kind of know that at some point all the cars are going to be self-driven, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you do in the car?
Like play games.
How do you sell the car? Like, because you were selling the car with the powerful feeling of driving or comfort or whatever, but now you're not the driver anymore. So you're gonna have that like a huge amount of time in your hands again, like for yourself. And entertainment is one of those things. So the screens they are getting bigger on all of the car manufacturers. In Air Console, we got a deal with the BMW to release Air Console gaming console on their couple of their car models, the newer ones. And kind of the way it works is that you use your mobile phone as a controller. So
okay.
So if you think about it, that's kind of a cool thing to do, because if you have only a touch screen, then you're trying to kind of point your finger to the touch screen of the car and try to holding your hand like on the extended for more than 5 minutes, you know, it's not going to be like a thing that you can play a long time. So for the for the mobile phone, it becomes like a controller that you can press your arms on your lap and really enjoy the game for a longer time. And the one thing that I kind of find really, really fascinating about the in-car gaming is that it's the first time since mobile phones that we have a new, let's say, a way to play games or a new gaming medium or new form function.
Definitely.
So that's kind of that's interesting part of that side of the business. And it's the one thing about those cars that I personally believe in is one of, from first-hand experience, is that those games, they elevate so much just because of the sound quality of the systems or the sound systems in the cars. Because usually you, like, if you have like Xbox or PlayStation in your home, in theory you can have like really good sound systems in there, like you can have surround sounds and whatever, but in practice probably most of the people only have stereo sounds, maybe, and if they have a significant other or kids or whatever when they're playing in the evening, they cannot put the volume
of course
super high. But on a car, all bets are off, because you're there alone, you can crank up the volume, and like simple games like Battleship, it actually feels way, way, way more fun on the in-car system rather than in your phone or even in your console. So like all of those things combined, and it probably there's going to be like a different type of a business model that we have used to in let's say free-to-play or even subscription to some extent.
And what is it going to be, some kind of like an app store for cars that you can like download games in the car, or like how is that going to work? Is it going to be mostly mobile games, or?
I hope not. I'm hoping that the future will be that the gaming industry, so that there will be enough cars on the roads that will have the capabilities of having like unique games that are designed for cars. So that's what I'm hoping for. So having games that are specifically designed for that space, that use case in mind, and really take into account of for seating arrangement of, for example, like there's two seats on the front and three on the back. So I don't know, one front seat versus back seat type of gaming, or that kind of thing. So I'm hoping that, or using the surround sound that you know that will be in there. So because on a console, you cannot use the surround sound as a like definitive gameplay mechanic. You always need to put something on support of that. But in a car, you could, because you know there's going to be a surround sound. So you could use the audio there to kind of really be crucial part of the gameplay. So that's my hope, that the car industry and the game industry will
join hands. Pretty exciting future.
Yeah. That's why I kind of wanted to join the Air Console in the first place, that be part of that journey.
But you're not there anymore now.
No, it's I think I got in there maybe a little bit too early in a way, because most of the parts on that side in Air Console specifically was kind of a lot of business development. A lot of working with smaller companies and larger companies to make those deals and make the, because the first part of every console launch is basically you make ports.
Mm-hmm.
So you port existing games so to have enough content, and then you start making the console specific content. So, and I'm a game maker, I'm not the business developer guy. So there was like a little bit of mismatch of my skills and what I was doing in Air Console. So I wasn't a good fit there, unfortunately, which was a shame, but it kind of happens every now and then.
What are your plans for the future?
Make games. I want to make games. I want to, or take an existing game and turn that into a great game. That's kind of that's why I'm still in games. That's why I like it. I want to make other people happy in the form of entertainment.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming over.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Really interesting conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate you making way here. And let's hope for a good future.
Yeah.
Video games.
I'm positive. Like, people are going to want to play games. Some people are going to make those games, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah.